You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Anna Sale, in for Leonard Lopate today. What's it been like to be a Muslim in post-9/11 America? What's it been like to raise Muslim kids? That varies widely, of course. The American Muslim population is a diverse mix of ethnic, social, and religious identities, but they can still get unceremoniously lumped together under one stereotype of potentially dangerous extremist. Manhattan writer Rania Tabari Idlibi says that when that happens to her and her family, it can feel like a jolt out of the blue. And it's prompted her to write a memoir called Burqas, Baseball, and Apple Pie, Being Muslim in America. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan. It's a follow-up to the 2007 New York Times bestseller she co-authored called The Faith Club, A Muslim, A Christian, A Jew, Three Women's Search for Understanding. We are pleased to have her in the studio today. Welcome to The Leonard Lopate Show.
I'm delighted to be here.
So a few years ago, during a book tour for The Faith Club, you wrote that a man stood up and challenged you to apologize for 9/11. Made me wonder who you hope your intended audience for this book is.
You know, when I write, I come to writing because I'm often confused, either as a parent or as a Muslim, and I'm seeking knowledge and truth and enlightenment in order for me to be a better American Muslim mother, parent. And so it's not so much the audience I'm thinking of as I write, but sort of empowerment for my children and knowledge for us as a family. The Omaha incident that you refer to was a gentleman who came up to me at the end of a presentation, and he kept saying to me, you know, you people are a source of violence all over the world. And I thought ease his discomfort by sharing my shared patriotism with him. And I said, you know, but your people, my people are one. I'm an American too. And he said to me, oh, no, you're not. So I'm so happy that he presented me with this question, because it was a trigger, a catalyst to what I call as part two of my journey. And if the Faith Club was finding my position as an American Muslim within the Judeo-Christian tradition, part two of this journey has been to consider our place as American Muslims to America, and then as progressive secular Muslims to Islam.
Your father is Palestinian. Your parents met in Chicago. You were born in Kuwait. Mm-hmm. You carried a Jordanian passport. Mm-hmm. You became a naturalized citizen at 22, and after you were studying international relations at Georgetown since you were 16. Yeah. In many ways, reading your book, it sounds a bit like a search for home, just a classic kind of immigration story.
Very much is. And even though we carried a Jordanian passport, I carried a Jordanian passport. I'd never lived in Jordan. I wasn't born there. And to be honest with you, I never felt secure in my citizenship until America has embraced us, and as it has embraced so many others before us. So for me, that part is America in its glory, it's in its promise. And we are the most recent of immigrants, and it's a path that's been traveled well before us by many other minorities before us.
Reza Aslan calls your book an intimate portrait of the coming-of-age experience of American Muslims. Mm-hmm. He was, of course, kind of famously confronted by a Fox News journalist when he was talking about his book that he wrote about Jesus, called Zealot, about whether it was appropriate for him as a Muslim to write that book. Have you had that feeling that there are some things that are off-limits for you to comment on and discuss as an American Muslim?
I think it's more sort of the idea that as an American, you may not quite be as American as the rest of Americans because of 9/11 and the issues within Islam, that some people will question perhaps the idea of the hyphenated identity of my children. They question the ability to be both American Muslim and proud. So in a sense, my children are a little bit compromised. I feel like that Islam is more of a burden than a privilege that I hand down to them. And therefore, it is incumbent, and it has been incumbent upon me as a mother, to not ask them to do so just out of ancestral loyalty, but out of a place of knowledge and awareness. And this has been part of my journey.
when September 11th happened, September 11th, 2001, was to be your daughter's first day of kindergarten. She was five, and you had a younger son. So now they're teenagers. It's been 12 years. How did parenting change for you after 9/11?
You know, it's very interesting you ask that question, because it's almost sort of, before 9/11, we were almost accidental Muslims. And after 9/11, it became the elephant in the room. Even if I chose to ignore it, it wouldn't ignore me. And I remember the story of the little picture that I, when I was asked to go visit my daughter's first grade class, I saw it. I didn't know about it. It was part of a project where they had to fill in the dots with "it's okay too." And most girls wrote "it's okay to be afraid of the dark" or "to have a blankie." And there's my daughter, and she had filled out "it's okay to be a Muslim when everyone around you is either Jewish or Christian." So parenting in a post 9/11 world is very different, in the sense that often my children stumble on these issues. They bring them home, and then I'm left trying to find the answers in the hope that perhaps one day they will be better Americans for it and better Muslims for it.
What is your relationship to Islam? You mentioned you felt like an accidental Muslim prior to 9/11. Were you raised in a religious home?
No, my mom is more religious than my father. I sort of am very spiritual. I like to say I have the God gene. I've always had the God gene. But before these two books and before 9/11, I wasn't sure that I even qualified as a Muslim. And I wasn't as confident in my voice as a Muslim. But today, having read up on these issues, I know that there are many progressive Muslims who are just like me. And I feel that the more interesting part of the journey for me has been that, you know, I call it the Aisha incident, actually, which is a report about Aisha, who was a Somali girl who was killed in the name of Muslim justice. Whereas before I would have excused that as a case of a failed Somali state, I think, you know, when I heard that report, I just sat down. She's 13 years old, the age of my daughter, and I wept. And suddenly that question that was most asked of me, which was "where are the moderates," suddenly sort of resonated with me a different way. Whereas before I would have thought, well, you know, 1.6 billion Muslims are moderates around the world. Clearly we're here, we're everywhere. It's just the bad news that gets reported. I suddenly felt like it wasn't enough to do that and say that we needed zero tolerance policy, zero tolerance when it comes to issues of stoning, amputations, flogging. We needed an Islam of the 21st century and not one invested in a 7th century Arabia.
Do you feel like the moderate Muslim community has grown in the 12 years since 9/11? How have you seen it change in terms of its sense of itself?
Oh, I think 9/11 has forced many Americans to examine the issues and to understand them. And I feel like many have taken that responsibility seriously. And we have Muslim comedians and artists and playwrights. So, yes, it's a thriving community. It's exciting to be part of it and to be part of that journey of assimilation.
I think it's interesting that the first word in your book is burqas, because you are not conspicuously Muslim. You do not wear a headscarf, and you note in your book that that was actually a point of pride in your family, that the women did not, you saw it as that women had a sense of power and strength that in your family, and as a result, chose not to wear the headscarves. Mm-hmm. Are there instances where you choose to pass and not identify as a Muslim person?
Very much so at the very beginning, before I started the Faith Club and then now this book. And it was just easier not to, you know, you would hear things that were kind of dubious or perhaps a little bit prejudiced, and you just let it slide by. Until one or two incidents where my children were beginning to develop an awareness. And one incident was part of the Faith Club experience, where a taxi driver said, "Oh, it must be these Muslims who are giving us these back pains." And my daughter looked at me, and I didn't say anything, and she said, "You know, you should have said something." And so, yes, this has been part of the journey, learning to speak up, and that has been the case.
Why burqas, baseball, and apple pie? Those are quite extreme contrasts. I mean, burqa, you can certainly be a practicing Muslim in the U.S. and not wear a burqa, and that's or you can be a moderate Muslim and perhaps, you know, not wear a burqa. Like, it's like, why that contrast?
You have my editor to either thank or blame for that title. And I know that some Muslims have taken issue with it because they were worried about the fact that burqas, in being in the title, would promote the stereotype that Islam is about burqas when it absolutely isn't. But the only reason being is it's catchy. We like the alliteration of the burqas baseball. And frankly, I talk about all these elements, the baseball part, the burqas part. For those interested, I'm not at all for burqas, but they're just as burqas do not represent Islam and apple pie does not represent Islam, nor baseball. I think it's just a title.
What's your relationship? What kind of conversations have you had with Muslims in the international community?
Well, we have been to Oman as part of the faith club, and we were so very well received. I think that, you know, what's interesting for me is the idea that as American Muslims, we understand that we need to proceed with confidence, that there is such a thing as an Islam that is culturally American, and not to feel vulnerable to those who speak on our behalf on the outside. The problem, of course, is that we're often, as American Muslims, held accountable to the latest headline news and to issues that happen thousands of miles away from us, just as in the case of Aisha. And we're called upon to be answerable to those issues. But as we grow and as we mature and we refine and define our voice, I look forward to a strong American Muslim tradition that is very much its own and not sort of complicated by the politics of abroad.
Here in New York, how do you see yourself fitting into the Muslim community? There's been a lot of activism around criticizing the NYPD surveillance in mosques and a real anger of feeling like the Muslim community is under suspicion in this city. Have you joined into those protests, or do you feel like that's not quite what your experience has been?
I haven't personally joined in the protests. I come to it as a mother. All I know is that no inflammatory positions are good positions. They're by definition un-American. I think what defines us as Americans is our earnestness, our desire to know, to learn, to bring to the table our very diverse backgrounds with the hope that, you know, we hold America accountable to its higher ideals. And we know what those ideals are. We don't need to be, they don't need to be reiterated. So I come to it as an American first. When issues such as, you know, over-aggressive surveillance or inflammatory videos are part of a training, then to me that's not just a Muslim issue, it's an American issue.
Hmm. Do you think your experience as a Muslim immigrant has been different than your kids who were born here as Muslims?
Absolutely. I mean, I had a foot in the East. I grew up there. I do have an awareness, perhaps, with this. I have a double vision, so I understand the issues from both angles. But, you know, I take it personally when we see placards out there saying, you know, Muslims go home, or my children have not known a home outside this neighborhood, this city, Manhattan, New York, America, and nor should they, and they do not carry any other citizenship, and religion is certainly not an ethnicity. This is their home. They are first and foremost American. So, yeah.
Do you and your kids feel at home when you go to mosque?
That's an interesting question. You know, I jokingly say, I have said that I suffered from temple and church envy. And I've been taken to task by my co-authors for that sentence, you know, so what do you exactly mean? Why don't you feel comfortable? And well, truth be told is that, I do yearn for a more progressive Muslim space where we can worship as a family, where my unveiled head and my daughters can walk in through the front entrance and not through a separate partitioned entrance. But again, that is the beauty of America and the promise of America. I know that the Jewish experience had the same type of journey before us and many other faith traditions.
So it sounds like right now the answer to that question about comfort in a mosque is no.
Not just yet, no.
What kind of response have you gotten from the Muslim community as you've put yourself out as a spokesperson for the experience of practicing Islam in America?
Do you know, I've had a few stereotypes myself busted in that process because, you know, just let me remind everyone, piety, orthodoxy does not mean extremism. I very much respect other Muslims' choices in being more orthodox or more ritualistic. It's just one amongst many. There's a plurality of experiences within the American Muslim experience. And I am very happy to report that I've had veiled women and more orthodox women come to me when we traveled as part of a faith club. We went everywhere from Boise, Idaho to Jacksonville, Florida. And they've come to me and embraced me, often sometimes with tears in their eyes, telling me that I speak for them.
How did you learn those lessons? You said you've had some stereotypes busted. I mean, did you have people come to you and say, I wear a headscarf, but I don't fit into this way of you describing piety as extremism?
Yes. I mean, clearly that this is their choice. They choose to follow the rituals in a certain way, and that's a choice. It doesn't mean that they're violent by definition or anti-Muslim by definition. So that's very much what obviously, I wasn't sure whether they would feel compromised by my understanding of Islam. Now, having said that, I did have one woman, and I write about her in the book, in Virginia, where she said to me, how can you sit here and say, you know, wearing a veil isn't part of our religious duty? And the pillars of Islam are the foundations upon which the house is built, and therefore you are a weak foundation. I don't choose to wear my religion on my head. I'm a believer in faith through action. I pray. I, in my own time, I'm very spiritual. So that's the beauty of America. Again, she chooses to be who she is, and I choose who to be and how I practice my faith. So while I respect her opinion, I very much feel that she needs to respect mine. At the end of the day, rituals and piety is often used by those who are more orthodox to in and out those who are more spiritual. And I think the schism between the two are exaggerated because it's a power play at the end of the day.
Has that power play, have you watched the dynamic there change? 9/11 is a prominent date in your book. 2007 is when your first book came out about cross-faith dialogue. Now this book comes out in 2014. How has the conversation changed within the Muslim community over that time as you've been engaging in it?
I think that there have been two reactions. There are those who are just, the issues are so overwhelming that they describe themselves as secular and other, and therefore they do not engage, and they sort of distance themselves from Islam. And I'm secular, I'm progressive. So sometimes the question is, why do you choose to self-identify as a Muslim? And I really think that it's part of the answer, because it's incumbent upon us to assume responsibility as progressive Muslims, or as, you know, to address the issues. I feel like it's not a choice we have. We can't disengage. We need to take them on. We need to take on issues of wife beating or stoning or what have you, diversity of plurality. If not us, then whom?
I imagine it's been difficult. If you, as a non-mosque-going Muslim, to be someone who stands up and says, these are the problems within our Muslim community, I imagine that's led to some difficult conversations about just whether you have the legitimacy to be that spokesperson.
That's another great question you ask. No one speaks for Islam. Often people say, well, who speaks for Islam? But part of the confusion is that really no one does, because Islam is a very much an individualistic faith where the relationship is between you and God, and it's a very private faith. Even mosque attendance is not required. It's very much a choice, and hence you see people rolling out a carpet in the middle of public spaces and praying. It's supposed to be something that you can do on a mountainside or in open air, as you would perhaps in a communal setting on a Friday. So we do not have a hierarchy. We do not have one equivalent of a pope. We do not have a spokesperson for Islam. It is the gift, but it is also the challenge, because who gets to speak for it is very much a challenge.
I've been speaking with Rania Tabari Idlibi about raising her Muslim family in America. Her book is called Burqas, Baseball, and Apple Pie, Being Muslim in America. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan. Rania, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.